ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Skye Kirkham and welcome to The Art Show on Radio National, where I'm bringing you some of our best conversations from the last year. Coming up later this hour, we head to England, where Daniel Browning catches Filipino artist Pio Abad in a pub in Cambridge to talk about post-colonial loss, disappearance and reimagining. You know, typical pub conversation. And we'll celebrate the life and art of Emily Karma Ngware. But first, Michael Doe speaks to the winner of the 2025 Hadley's Art Prize, Sophie Cape.
Some paintings are sealed off from the world, neat, polished, contained. But Sophie Cape's canvases, they do the opposite. Her works feel porous, weathered by the elements themselves. Soil, ash, rust, bone. Not so much painted as unearthed, carrying the traces of time, of memory, of endurance. Once an elite athlete, Sophie turned to art after devastating injuries. And since then, she's gone on to forge a practice that is physical, cathartic, unafraid of risk. And it's a path that's brought her attention and acclaim, including winning this year's Hadley's Art Prize, Australia's richest prize for landscape painting. Today, we're joined by artist Sophie Cape. Sophie, hi.
Hi, Michael. Sorry, I'm still floating on cloud nine.
No apologies at all. Sophie, let's start with the Hadley Prize winning work, Thunder Shifts, The Shivering Sands. Now, the judges praised it as less of a picture of a landscape, but actually more of a collaboration with nature. Tell me, what inspired the work and how did you go about making it?
Oh, I like that word, collaboration with the with nature. Yeah, it's very much that. I think, as you mentioned before, that I used to be an athlete. And look, I just, you know, all those Olympic dreams were shattered and I ended up at art school and I found a way of making art that was, I guess, there was therapy. You said cathartic, which is better, yeah. And it's, I just love getting out, getting down and dirty in the bush. I love the tactility. They call me the dirt collector, or some of my friends do. But yeah, it's not, I'm not trying to paint a portrait of like a viewfinder landscape that I'm looking at. I want to try and express the sense of the space, the emotion of it, the heat, the drama, the drought, the death, the life, all of that nitty-gritty stuff that's out, particularly in the Australian landscape. And I found a way that the process for me is deeply important, more so than the end product. So I will be out there for weeks at a time. I'll sleep out there in a swag with my dog and just basically just every morning I wake up and I'm like, oh, what have I got this morning? I'll go and throw something in one direction and there'll be a gust of wind and it will go the opposite way. And I'm like, oh, okay. Because I work on the ground and I work with whatever I find. So the materiality and the materials are very important. So wherever I am, whatever location I choose, I source pigment, burnt trees for charcoal, or make brushes out of branches and use everything around me. I don't really shop at art shops, and use everything around me to create that artwork. So I love that animals get into it. They get blown away. I've lost them in dams, over cliffs. God, I've lost so many canvases around the country. It's not funny. But yeah, I love that the elements are, it's like a tug of war, I suppose, with them. But I really enjoy that and I love the excitement of it. Whereas if I'm in a studio and I go and make a line, it goes exactly where I intend it to. Whereas if I'm out in the landscape and I do that, it definitely does not do that.
Well, Sophie, I've seen footage of you working and it's quite remarkable. You're sort of sprawled on the paper, you're in dirt, flinging paint. I mean, you just said a real surrendering to the elements, to the wind, to the weather. And so tell me how this way of working came about, because you could make work in the very neat container of a studio, but being outside on plein air, that's a completely different proposition.
Yeah, I know. I just don't enjoy it in the studio. I know they talk about the white, you know, canvas and page and stuff. I just feel like there's chaos, there's uncertainty, there's fear, there's adrenaline, there's all of these elements that come into the process when I work outside that would never ever happen in the studio. Like, the, you know, they talk about the happy accident, but that happens once in a blue moon in the studio, whereas when I'm out in the landscape it happens all the time. I've just got to deal with it. I mean, I remember having to strip almost half naked and crawl through a dam trying to find canvases that had sunk months prior that I didn't realise. And I looked up to find this poor old farmer looking at me like I was an idiot. But I really enjoy that. I really love the process of making works this way. I find it really fun, exciting. I don't know what's going to happen. No work is ever planned. Like, people are like, oh, do you know what you're going to make? And I'm like, no, absolutely not. There's no way.
When I look at your works, they're not just landscape. There's something a bit more personal about them, a bit more sort of activated. And you've called them as a sort of cathartic self-portrait. And so can you tell me a little bit more about this relationship between self and the land?
Yeah, well, I guess because having been an athlete for so long, it was sort of like you're competing against nature, and I really missed that physicality, but I couldn't do it anymore because I had, well, at the time I retired, like over 70 broken bones, concussions, so on and so on. And I just, being that physical wasn't an option anymore, so I needed to find something that gave me that sort of sense but wasn't as demanding. So working out in the landscape, being exposed to the elements, not knowing what's going to happen every minute to minute, was I just loved so much. And I found that pretty much, well, I guess the best replacement I have. I mean, I tried all sorts of horrible other things, but that was the best replacement I found. And yeah, it's, I guess it is very physical. Like, originally, I remember when I was at art school, I was trying to do self-portraits of myself, obviously, but it just sort of, it was great, a great learning experience, but I wasn't getting anything out of it more than that. And I had this amazing teacher, Bill Wright, and he said, here, why don't you get a massive piece of paper, stand in the middle of it and paint how you feel about yourself or the space, right? So you kind of, you're doing a portrait but from the inside out rather than the outside in. And it just sort of exploded from there, and I just took it out to the bush because, you know, it just made more sense. And I, yeah, developed this art practice where it's just myself, the puppy, and the four-wheel drive.
And when you got out into the bush, Sophie, when was that moment? Tell me about that moment where it all just clicked into place and you thought, right, this is how I should be doing things.
Oh, look, it never really clicks into place, let's be honest. Every artist has massive amounts of self-doubt constantly. It's very frustrating. Which is why it's so funny about the Hadley's Art Prize, because I'd literally pretty much just royally given up. And I was like, yeah, it's but I think I had my first art trip whilst I was at art school, and it was to the Flinders Ranges with a bunch of amazing artists, Ewan McLeod, Elizabeth Cummings, Lex Cabarrus, Guy Maestri, my mum, who's also an artist, Guy Warren. There was a whole load of them. I was so lucky to be involved. I don't know how to explain it. It was amazing.
Yeah. And tell me about the journey from being an elite athlete. And you've lived another life, really, as an elite athlete. And that transition from injury and despair to finding and making art.
Yeah, I sort of feel like I've had multiple lives, and there are times when I'm like, I'm so tired. I think I've used up all of my life's energy already. The words you used just then were really nice. I don't know. Whenever I was an athlete, I would sort of, whenever I was on crutches again, I'd go back and do another 6 months of study and then back to training and then another 6 months. It was really hard when, because you come back, and finally when you can't come back anymore, I think there's a real issue in Australia where athletes are highly prized, but nobody ever sort of really thinks about all the millions of athletes that don't make it and what happens to them. I was just incredibly fortunate that I had something else that I managed to fall back on. But it is really tough.
Now, Sophie, you just mentioned your mother, Anne Cape, and she's also an artist herself. Tell me about her influence on your work.
I think she is the most brilliant drafts person and portrait painter in the country today. Not being biased, she is incredibly talented, but she taught me so many great fundamental skills, but also because she was an artist, I ran in the opposite direction. You know what it is, what it's like. You don't want to do what your parents do. Look, I was always surrounded by art. It was always a part of my life. We were always going to exhibition openings, and I think that's something that is really missing in Australia. Like, it's lovely when you travel overseas. As much as I love Australia, when you're overseas, people are like, oh, you're an artist. And whereas here they go, oh, you paint houses. Or it's just, and I was just lucky to grow up in that world. But like I said, because my family and my grandmother was a painter as well, I completely ran in the opposite direction until I didn't really have a choice. And then I thought, I'll just go to art school for 6 months because you're all annoying me so much. And I loved it, absolutely loved it, and I've never looked back. And I went to the National Art School, which is, well, I don't really know how to explain it. It's a life-changing place. It's incredible.
Set against the old jail and a real sort of attention.
It was perfect
to
me.
Yes, a real sort of attention to old world.
Have you ever been there?
Classical techniques. Yes, it's pretty majestic.
Yeah.
Sophie, and what did they see in you, this sort of lineage of female artists in your family? Because clearly they pestered you, and so they must have seen some sort of artistic glimmer that you had not recognized yet.
Yes. Okay. I won colouring in competitions, Ginger Meg skateboards, all sorts of weird things when I was like a little tyke. And it was just always present. And I always loved drawing and painting and anything creative. And it was when I was a skier, I used to go out and paint the landscape and take photographs. And when I was a cyclist, I used to paint people's helmets and their bikes. Like, it's sort of, it was always there. I just didn't want to know about it, if that makes sense.
Sophie, we've talked a lot about the work you do in the Australian bush, but the work doesn't stop there. You've worked in the Parisian catacombs, the streets of Berlin, the ski slopes of Austria. So tell me, when you shift where you work, and when you move outside of Australia, how does the land call you differently?
Yeah, I was always excited because I was so drawn to the Australian landscape because it's so brutal, that survival and decay element and that beauty and the horror, death, destruction, but life, all of that sort of stuff that I love so much. And I always wondered how that would translate in other landscapes. And so as an artist, you have this amazing opportunity to undergo residencies overseas. And like you said, yeah, I did some in Austria, Poland, Paris. And it was fascinating because I just hunted out that sort of similar energy. So the Paris, I found the people, the punks that used to live in the catacombs and went down there and worked in the pitch black and made works. And then I, when I was in Austria, it was freezing cold, I like took myself outside and made works out in the snow, which eventually got annihilated by an avalanche, which then took another week to dig out and so on and so forth. But all of this stuff I love because it adds to the texture, the history, the information of that place. So, yeah, I don't think it matters where I work. I will find a way of somehow translating the energy and the emotion of that space, I hope, anyway.
And the way you work as well, because you mentioned you very rarely buy art materials anymore. You're using bone, stick, rusk, farming tools that are kind of stitched into canvas. And so when you are in these remote, faraway places, what are the materials that find you and find the paintings?
Well, probably shouldn't tell customs this, but Paris, I ended up with some human bones in the canvases. In Austria, because I was out in the snow consistently for weeks and weeks and weeks, every time I went to put paint down or whatever it was, it would be frozen. And when I did finally get something on the canvas, it would be completely shifted that night because of the snowfalls. So it was sort of, I seemed to find a way of infecting the works with the landscape that I'm working in, no matter where I am, but that's, for me, that's the fun of it. That's the what's exciting.
And I want to talk more about material, which is so important to your practice. I've read that you've called paper sexy, and I'm really quite curious about that. Tell me what you meant.
Oh, drawing is beautiful. It's a beautiful thing to do. It is so divine. It's like making a beautiful line on a beautiful piece of paper with a beautiful piece of charcoal or graphite or something. It's just so sexy. It's gorgeous. And when I see artworks that have those sort of marks in them, I am 100% drawn to them. And I love making those sorts of marks. And paper is basically one of the smoothest surfaces you can work on. And it's crunchy and it's delicious. And I love working on that. But most of the time I work on canvas because I've got to roll them up, drag them around the world. I destroy them. So paper's a little bit fragile, but yes, it is. Paper and drawing, yes, it's very sexy for me.
Sophie, winning the Hadley, it's a pretty amazing feat. It's a prize that's worth $100,000, and you've called it a lifeline. So tell me, what does it mean practically for an artist trying to make work, have a career, and be a professional artist, what this prize has done for you?
Oh, a very complicated question. It's when you become an artist, you know that it's going to be hard, but it has been very, very hard the last few years post-COVID. The market sales are really poor, so it's been harder than normal to survive as an artist. And I'd taken on a second job. I was up to my armpits in garbage. I was cussing and swearing. It was raining. I was on this property, and I got this amazing phone call from Hadley's, and I was just like, oh, wow. Okay, so I can get all my medical stuff fixed. I can get my dog stuff fixed. I can get my car fixed, and I can head back out to the bush, which is amazing. Or even head back overseas, which would be incredible.
To sustain the sort of inspiration and
I was very, very, very close to calling it quits. I was like, Because like I said, you know, I've always thought if I was authentic and I worked really, really hard and I made stuff that meant a lot to me in my past, that it would connect or resonate with people, that it didn't matter, I would survive. And it did just reach a point where I was like, I don't know if that's even enough. So, yes, and I kind of feel like at the moment in Australia, art prizes are sort of the only income artists have at the moment that's worthwhile. So I'm deeply grateful.
Mm. And Sophie, tell me about that crisis of faith, because as you say, being an artist is really hard. But what kept you going when you were, you know, arms deep in garbage, as you say?
Not much. That was pretty much the end of the line. I've been doing it for 15, 20 years since art school, since Tim Olson picked me up. And it's been an amazing ride, but it has reached a point where it's tough. It's really tough. And, you know, sometimes I will always make art, but it's like, oh, okay, I need to really seriously think about another source of income, a proper source of income. But so that call came through and saved my life.
But was there a person, was there an artwork, was there a memory, something that made you grip closer to this lifelong ambition of being an artist?
I don't know. People ask me often about my inspiration and my idols and all that sort of stuff. For me, it's more about just being a human being on this planet and our very human condition, and trying to find a way of explaining that to myself, and hopefully thereby maybe portraying something that means something to somebody else. But also, like I was saying before, like the process for me is so cathartic and therapeutic that for a long, long time, it didn't really matter if the work sold or not, like, or what was on the wall. But there does come a point where you do need to survive.
Absolutely. And that is the reality of being an artist. It's not a meritocracy. Nothing is guaranteed and you're independent. You have no protection from the whipsaw of the market.
No. You don't. You've got no insurance. You've got no super. You've got no, like, nothing. You're flying blind. So it's kind of terrifying, but it's also, you have the best life in the universe as well. So,
and Sophie, tell me, after all of this, the land, the body, the new career, the ruin, the risk, when someone's standing in front of your works, what do you want to linger for them? What's your message?
Well, it's interesting because I never really, when you're at art school or whatever, you don't really think about that end of the process. But I have stood next to people that have burst into tears in front of my works and I've been like, what? Which is amazing, amazing for me. And, I mean, that's the state often that I'm in when I'm creating the work. I just never believe that it will translate to somebody viewing the work, but it has done in the past, and I think that's quite extraordinary.
That was Sophie Cape, the winner of the 2025 Hadley's Art Prize for Landscape, talking to Michael Doe. You're listening to The Art Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Skye Kirkham. In a little while, you'll meet the filmmaker Danielle McLean and hear about her documentary on the Australian painter Emily Karma Ngware. But next, Daniel Browning meets UK-based Filipino artist Pio Abad.
According to his bio, the work of London-based Filipino artist Pio Abad is concerned with the personal and political entanglements of objects. And not just any objects, storied ones. They're wrapped in a tissue of historical violence or inhumanity or excess or corruption. And he's interested in how those stories reverberate or implicate us in the present. Pio's starting point is always his own experience in the rich and turbulent history of the Philippines and the struggle for democracy after hundreds of years of colonial rule by Spain and then the US and a military dictatorship. His exhibition of drawings, some even laser cut on marble, didn't just include his own work, it also drew on museum collections. And it was nominated for Britain's most high-profile, if not controversial, art prize last year. To Those Sitting in Darkness was first exhibited at Oxford's Ashmolean Museum. And then it went on to the Tate Britain for the Turner Prize exhibition that was late last year. Abad mined the stories embedded in certain objects held at Oxford's various repositories. And with his jeweller wife even cast a 3D reconstruction of a Russian-style tiara, last worn by Imelda Marcos. But the entire exhibition was inspired by a 17th century etching of a tattooed slave known as Giolo, who was picked off an island in either the southern Philippines or northern Indonesia and taken to the UK by the English buccaneer, William Dampier. Once there, Giolo was traded as a freak show curiosity. Not only that, after he died from smallpox, Giolo was flayed by a surgeon and his tattooed skin preserved as an anatomical rarity. Pio Abad's work struck a chord with me, as someone who's interested in the thousands of Indigenous people trafficked abroad for dubious reasons during the colonial period. I arranged to meet Pio last December while I was on a fellowship at Cambridge. It was the day before the Turner Prize was announced. So we're sitting in the quietest corner we could find in my local, the Punter, on Pound Hill.
So the title of the exhibition, it's an alteration of the title of a Mark Twain essay. And the essay is called To the Person Sitting in Darkness, because not only was Mark Twain, you know, an incredible novelist, but he was also a staunch anti-imperialist. And in 1901, just as when the United States was beginning to, or actually wrapping up its endeavors in colonizing the Philippines, Mark Twain wrote this essay, To the Person Sitting in Darkness, to excoriate the United States, you know, colonization of the Philippines, which they called annexation, which sounds like such a much more benign word than, you know, actual bloody conquest. And this essay obviously talks about the evangelizing undertones of American colonization. And so I've used that title, but I wanted to expand the remit. So from To the Person Sitting in Darkness, I wanted it to include not just people, but also, you know, objects that have been, I guess, witnesses to or residues of conquest. And so To the Person Sitting in Darkness kind of expands on Twain's discussion of colonialism, but also on a very kind of rudimentary level. Part of the exhibition was alongside, you know, exhibiting my own artworks, I was also excavating artifacts from Oxford, from London, from the British Museum, from Pitt Rivers, that have never been shown before since they were accessioned. And so, you know, To Those Sitting in Darkness, it's just addressing things in storage where they've lived for 100, 120, 150 years.
Now, these objects, they are in darkness, sitting in darkness. We call them anxious objects, objects which tell a history which perhaps the curators or the guardians of that collection may not wish others to see. What's the trigger? I mean, there is a particular print, a bill, advertising a Filipino man who was brought to Europe. I think that's the very, is that the kind of core,
yes,
where it begins?
Yes, so that print is the foundation of the inquiry, really. You know, so for 2.5 years, I spent, you know, numbers of hours, many, many hours, like excavating, you know, libraries, archives, the back rooms of Oxford's various historical institutions. And I came across this, it's a print. It's an advertisement from 1692. And it's, you know, this beautiful etching depicting a man covered from neck to toe in tattoos. And the etching is an invitation for people to witness this man in various pubs in Fleet Street. This man, they called him the Painted Prince because of the markings on his body. But I think what I found striking about that print was it was probably one of the first depictions of a trafficked Filipino body in historical archives. And so I think I then kind of wanted to find a way to bring this painted prince. We find out later his name was Giolo, and he probably wasn't a prince. And he probably wasn't a man. He was most likely a boy, because there was also, you know, some writing about him being taken with his mother. And I wanted to bring Giolo out of the archives and tell a story, you know, both as a way of monumentalizing this forgotten figure, but also a way of bringing back some kind of humanity. And as I kind of dug deeper into the story, it kind of, you know, the layers of pain and the layers of kind of historical violence kept on adding up. You know, he was, you know, brought by the British buccaneer, British pirate, William Dampier from the south of the Philippines to London, where he was sold off to, I don't know, I can imagine these carnival barkers who would collect people. And he was shown around London for a number of years until he contracted smallpox, where he was brought to Oxford to recuperate, but he succumbed to the disease. And when he died, his skin was actually excised from his body and for a number of years shown at the Bodleian Library as part of the College of Anatomy. And, you know, so I wanted to tell that story, but I also wanted to do other things and like I said, monumentalize him, humanize him, and tell a more, I guess, a more complex, less, you know, not end with a tragedy, but to find other ways to tell that story by linking this narrative to other stories and to kind of by creating works in response to this story.
In your work, I guess it's, have a drink. we're in a pub in Cambridge, retreating from the cold. But in telling that story, in mining, I guess, a visual archive, history, you are talking about a relationship that, say, colonial subjects, people like you and I, who come from former colonies of somewhere else, European colonies. The work also talks about a relationship, and it's an opportunity too, not to talk about pain and guilt or, you know, trauma or grief, but also about the relationship and just to, you know, marvel at the history and the length of time that we've been interacting. What's been the reaction, though, to your work, broadly speaking?
Oh, I think with this particular work, I think there's been, it's been encouraging, actually, the fact that, you know, there's been such a positive response to the exhibition. But also, I think what I've enjoyed about, you know, watching people visit the exhibition was that there was a willingness to slow down and really take on the details of these stories, like alongside these historical objects. You know, I've written texts that people, you know, can read in the exhibition. But I think in particular with this print, it's installed alongside a wall with two other works kind of operating as a kind of triptych. And, you know, talking about relationships, when I was thinking about of how to present this bill, I thought that I wanted Giolo, the tattooed prince, the tattooed boy, to encounter another tattooed figure. And in this instance, that tattooed figure is a self-portrait of the Filipino-American artist Carlos Villa, who was a really important educator in San Francisco from the 80s to the, I think up until his death in the mid-2000s. But this artwork that I borrowed from Carlos Villa's estate depicts Carlos Villa as, you know, a self-portrait, but he's drawn images relating to the tattooing culture of Pacific Islander communities on his face. So they're not kind of specific to specific indigenous communities, but he kind of made his own kind of markings. And so this work, Tattoo from 1971, you know, was a way for Carlos Villa to, I guess, use tattooing as a way of enacting some kind of syncretic solidarity with other Pacific Islander cultures. And so that was the initial encounter I wanted to stage between Giolo, for whom tattooing became a form of incarceration. But then with Carlos Villa, tattooing becomes an act of solidarity. So between that space is, I feel like there that's something that can be activated, explored in many different ways. And it doesn't end with, the flayed skin in a colonial building, but somewhere else. It ends in the ocean. And then the third work in this triptych is a work I made, which is a series of 11 laser engravings on marble depicting Giolo's hand, which is almost Renaissance-like in how it's grasping. Or, I think of that, the most famous hand grasping, which is Adam and God at the Sistine Chapel. By drawing Giolo's hand and engraving it onto marble, there was this attempt to monumentalize him, but the marble is pink and fleshy, so it goes back to a kind of frailty, a human frailness. So there was this tension. And so I think, these conversations, these interactions, really was the reason behind this exhibition, a way to kind of to find these spaces where conversations that can never happen anywhere else, can be imagined, where, these communities across time and space can be convened within a gallery space.
This particular body of work, how does it relate to the kind of broader narrative of your work? Are you concerned with these themes across your work, or is this new terrain for those who don't know your work?
I think it's a bit of both. It's a continuation of a long kind of decade and a half long inquiry into the political weight that objects carry, and it's a continuation of this interest in Philippine history, not so much because I'm interested in the idea of nation, but more because the Philippines is an interesting starting point to look at the larger history of colonialism, the larger history of empire. But because it's the history I know intimately, I will always begin there. All my exhibitions are referred to as solo exhibitions, but actually they are, for me, attempts to bring communities together. So this particular exhibition that's been nominated for the Turner and is in show at Tate Britain actually includes myself, my collaborations with my wife, who's a jewelry designer named Frances Wadsworth Jones, an artwork by Carlos Villa, historical material, some Mindanao weaponry that we borrowed from the British Museum and the Pitt Rivers, but also incredible woven fabric by a collective in the Philippines called Sinagtala. So it really is, I've always been interested in cultural material. And all of these shows really is they're less about production, but more about convening these communities, convening my sort of diasporic community together. But in terms of what my work has looked like in the past, I think a lot of it's been rooted in drawing. And for the last 10 years, I've sort of finished that body of work now, but I've been, obsessed is the wrong word, but I've been working on this 10-year-long project of kind of working on reconstructing the collection of Imelda and Ferdinand Marcos, who were, as many people know, particularly in Australia, they are, the kind of Philippine kleptocrats who ruled as a conjugal dictatorship from the 60s to the 80s. And now the son is actually back in power. But so I've been, reconstructing this incredible collection they've had of old master paintings, which I remade as postcards, their collection of furniture, which I made into sort of really intricate ink drawings, and their jewelry, which me and my wife Frances have remade into almost like 3D printed ghosts. And so this, I think these kind of choreographies of corruption, of empire, and of impunity kind of carry on in the practice, but largely often contained in drawing.
Isn't there a tiara in the Ashmolean show?
There is, yeah. So that's...
Francis must have been involved in the making of that.
Yeah, so, yeah, Francis is an incredible jewellery designer. And when I started working on Imelda Marcus's jewellery collection, it seemed organic to collaborate together, particularly because family has always been such an important part of this project. You know, my parents, my mum, my dad and my late mum were both very much involved in the anti-dictatorship movement in the 70s and 80s. And when the dictatorship fell in 86, you know, they were involved in the impossible task of rebuilding democracy in the country after 20 years of authoritarianism. So that history has always been present in the work. So it makes sense that family shifts from being archival to being almost an agent in producing the work. So with Francis, we've been reconstructing Imelda's jewelry, which is not an easy task because no one has seen any of these in 30 years. And so we're basing these very...
They're all gone. She took them with her to Hawaii?
So she took them with her. Some of them were confiscated and brought back to the country where they've been sitting in various vaults. But now that they're back in power, do they have access to them again? No one knows. But for a brief moment, I think in 2016, we were able to access some images of the jewelry, literally one JPEG of each. And so from those singular JPEGs, Francis has kind of painstakingly reconstructed each item facet by facet on the computer, which are then 3D printed, cast in bronze, or even in the case of this show, remade as a 3.5 meter long concrete monument. I've always found it's so many layers of stories in every object in the show, but maybe the tiara is the most layered because it's about an object recurring across history. And I think jewelry in particular is interesting when you talk about the ends of empires. Yeah, you know, there's a story and this will make sense as I tell the story more, but you know, when there's that famous story, I guess the most famous story about jewelry and ends of empire is the Romanov story, where, you know, when the Romanov family were being executed by the Bolsheviks, supposedly it took a very long time for them to be killed because they'd lined the insides of their clothes.
The duchesses had lined their skirts with jewels. Yeah.
And that story is relevant to the tiara because the tiara is actually part of the Romanov hall. It was the favorite pearl, diamond, and I think gold tiara of the last Romanov empress. And it was, you know, when they were executed in 1917 and the Bolsheviks took this collection, it was kept by Stalin for a while. But then when Stalin needed to fund his reimagining of the Russian agricultural system according to communist tenets, he collaborated with Christie's, as you do, to sell on this tiara, which then found its way to Oxford because it was bought by the Duchess of Marlborough. And then the Duchess dies in 1977 and the tiara is auctioned off again and it ends up, surprise, surprise, in Manila, because Imelda Marcos, having inhaled these histories of royalty and wanting to project herself as a kind of empress of the Philippines, needed the hardware to match the ambition. And so it ended up on Imelda Marcos's head. And then when the Marcoses were kicked out of office, or now we know temporarily, the tiara disappeared. And for a brief moment, when there was a government in the Philippines in 2015 that maybe wanted to make things better, there was a brief moment where we thought the tiara would be auctioned off again by Christie's to support agricultural reform in the Philippines. But then that didn't happen because darker forces prevailed, and the tiara is now stuck in some vault in Manila, never to be seen again. And so
in darkness.
And so in the exhibition, we have these two bronze reconstructions of the tiara, bronze being the material of permanence, of incontrovertibility almost. But they're in the gallery kind of facing each other, almost like witnessing their recurrence throughout time. It's a long story, but I got there in the end.
Love these kind of complex stories. And yes, jewelry does, as you would know, as anyone listening would know, jewelry seems to possess something of the spirit of the previous owner. We attribute or ascribe particular pieces of jewelry certain meaning. Fascinating. But thank you so much for being my guest on The Art Show.
No, absolute pleasure.
Turner Prize-nominated artist Pio Abad there with Daniel Browning at a Cambridge pub. You're listening to The Art Show on Radio National. I'm Sky Kirkham. And staying in the UK, London's Tate Modern is currently featuring the work of one of Australia's most renowned and most valuable artists, Emily Karma Ngware. It's her first major collection show in Europe, with over 70 pieces on display. In 2025, Ngware was also the subject of a documentary that first screened at the Sydney Film Festival and is now on SBS On Demand. Emily, I Am Karma, which tells the story of her art, her country, and her life. Danielle McLean is the documentary's director. Danielle, welcome.
Thank you.
So who was Emily Ngware? She wasn't just an important artist. She was a senior figure in her community, a very important figure.
Yes, so she was a senior woman of the Ulalgra ladies for Ulalgra country. And she took part in ceremony, obviously, as a young woman, and then as a senior woman, painted women's bodies and held on to stories and passed stories for, you know, to the next generation, and dances and songs. So she was a really significant cultural figure in that community, but also an amazing artist. Her work obviously moved from kind of her cultural world to the canvas.
And it's so interesting that the work most of us know her for, that work on the canvas, only came very late in life, didn't it? It was condensed over a short period.
Yeah, that's right. It was about eight years of her life. She'd done a batiking for 11 years before that, but then she moved on to canvas and with acrylic paint, but she produced up to, it says, 3,000 paintings in that time. So she worked hard, from all accounts, it sounds like she needed to paint.
And the work is truly remarkable. One of the things that stood out to me in your documentary was you were talking to her kinfolk from that country and showing them the work, or they were seeing the work, and they had such a deep understanding of the paintings. And it made me realize how limited my own vocabulary is. I've seen some of the paintings. I love them. They're beautiful. They're wonderful, but I don't understand them at a deep level. And these women saw it and they knew the stories that were being told. What does it mean to see that understanding of the art? Sort of what are we missing, and how can we as a general audience gain that understanding? Or should we? Is it enough to appreciate it from a distance?
I think that was one of the things we tried to achieve with the documentary, was to give Emily and her community, the Ulalgra and Anangra ladies, their own voice around this, and to actually welcome us as outsiders into that community to gain a bigger understanding, a greater understanding of Emily's work. I mean, the reality is she is painting country and they know that country so intimately, like her. So what looks like dots and lines on a painting to us and lovely colours is really significant. And they're maps of land and country and how people move across them, how ancestral beings travelled across them to create those landscapes and stuff as well. So those ceremonies pass through those places. So they know them so intimately, from when they're young girls to adults. They get more and more knowledge of those places and obviously pass that knowledge on to the next generation.
Yeah, and you've got some wonderful shots from the sky, but also really close up on yam roots and the like that take us into the land, into the country that she was painting. Was that your sort of trying to communicate to the audience what those paintings were telling?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was trying to, obviously, because we had her archival recording of her voice and stuff, we wanted to be able to to translate those recordings. But, you know, we really wanted to try to get that understanding of what these things mean, because, yes, they're the physical, they're the things underground, they're the yams, they're the seeds, but they're also about the creation or recreation and of those plants and animals and stuff. So, you know, the obligation to dance and sing for those things. So there's more of them on country and for the next generation. You know, it's it was a really interesting process, actually, just getting to be on country with the ladies and seeing how alive it still was.
This is an art story, but it's also a story of some of the biggest political moments of the last century in Australia. She was, you know, there alongside the land rights movement, a big part of that. The stolen children, stolen generation is part of the story you're telling here. How did you want to include the gravity, the wealth, the experience that she had beyond just the art?
I think as an Aboriginal person, being Aboriginal, you are political because all those policies affect your life so intimately. You know, the reality was her land was taken from her. She worked on stations. She worked, you know, for rations. She worked, you know, she fought for her land back. All of those things made her the person she was. And those old people were actually very political. They did get off their butts. They marched. They said, we're not accepting this anymore, you know. So that was part of her story. And I think her art is political in lots of ways too, because she's painting her country and she said, this is mine. I own this. I've got obligations to it and to my family, to my kinswomen. So I think it all actually is part of her story.
What does it mean to have this art going to what is basically the heart of empire? You know, talking back to the UK, to Europe in a way.
I think that what you've just said is quite amazing, because I think the reality is it's trying to give people insight into how people see this country and their own country and their obligations to country and what drives them to protect country. So I think they are really great in this world that we're living in right now. It's really great to look at First Nations storytellers, but also, you know, landowners, community people that actually have got some of the answers and how we should be looking after our planet.
That was Danielle McLean, director of the documentary Emily, I Am Karma, which you can catch now on SBS On Demand. That's all the time we have today, but before we wrap up, some important news. As you may have heard, this is the final episode of The Art Show on Radio National, at least for now. Don't go anywhere, though. Radio National will continue bringing you great art content throughout 2026. It will just sound a little different. Starting next week, Claire Nichols will bring you interviews from the worlds of the visual and performing arts on The Arts Hour, every Monday through Thursday from 10 a.m. A massive shout out to everyone who has poured their heart and soul into this show over the years, including Ed LeBrock, Edwina Stott, Namilla Benson, Anna Frey Taylor, Daniel Browning, Rosa Ellen, Michael Doe, Ramesh Marionithyendran, and of course our executive producer Rhiannon Brown, and all the amazing sound team here at Radio National. And thanks to you, the listener, and to all the great artists who've joined us for keeping us company over the years. We've loved being with you on this ride. If you're missing the show, the entire archives of The Art Show are available on the ABC Listen app or the RN homepage. The Art Show is produced by Tony Norton. I'm Skye Kirkham, and for one last time, thank you for joining us on The Art Show.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.